You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. We often talk about various treatment methods for addiction, and tonight we're talking about finding recovery through the tenets of Buddhism. Refuge recovery is a systematic method based on Buddhist principles which integrate scientific, non-theistic, and psychological insight. Noah Levine is our guest. He's the founder of Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. With centers in Los Angeles and San Francisco and over 20 affiliated groups in North America and Europe. He teaches meditation groups, gives workshops, and leads retreats internationally. Noah has created a process of addiction recovery based on the teachings of the Buddha called Refuge Recovery, which is the title of his new book, Refuge Recovery, A Buddhist Path to Recovering from Addiction. He's also the author of Dharma Punks, Against the Stream, Heart of the Revolution, and Refuge Recovery.
He's Noah, been a busy writer. A
busy man. Noah, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Thanks, guys.
Hi,
really
Noah.
Happy to be here.
So talk about how you came across the idea of refuge recovery.
Well, it all began for me, with addiction, of course, being, strung out at a young age, ending up in juvenile hall over and over. And at 17 years old, I ended up kind of being ready. I started getting sent to 12-step groups when I was like 12 years old. So all through my adolescence, I was in kind of recovery conversation, but I wasn't ready. And at 17, while I was locked up, my father taught me meditation. He taught me Buddhist meditation. And that, had a profound effect on my life. And for the first time in my life, I realized that there was some hope that I could learn through my own efforts, through a meditative practice, to no longer obey the craving, no longer obey my mind, and to start a process of recovery. So it all started, while I was detoxing in juvenile hall back in 1988. I'm a slow learner. The first couple of years, I wasn't real consistent or thorough with my meditation. But at a couple of years sober, I started doing Buddhist meditation retreats. Now, along with that, for me, I always also did 12-step and, went to meetings and felt good about that and found a community that was supportive. But the core philosophy of the 12-step, what I see as a Judeo-Christian ideal, never really resonated with me. But the Buddhist teachings always really made perfect sense to me. So eventually, just a few years ago, after having used Buddhism for my recovery, I said, okay, it's time for somebody to step out and say, Buddhism is a completely appropriate and thorough approach to treating addiction. And so that's what I've been doing for the last few years.
Noah, can you tell us what Dharma Punks is? I heard the name Dharma Punks long before I ever knew what it was, and certainly it's one of your more famous pieces of work. Would you share a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, for me, I grew up in the punk scene and was a little, especially when I got off of drugs, because punk rock in the early days was about rebellion and anarchy and, social critique and trying to create a positive change in this world. And then I lost those ideals into just, oblivious drug addiction, violence, and crime. When I got sober and I started meditating, I started reading a lot of the beatniks and reading a lot of that early American spiritual wanderer adventure, stories of the Beats, Kerouac and Burroughs and all of those wonderful writers. And at some point when I became more and more Buddhist and more identified with that, I said, oh, this, you know, these guys in the 1950s are talking about what I'm doing now, right, in the 1980s or early 90s, about being an American who's committed to spiritual practice. And so for them, you know, it got coined Dharma bums. You know, they were out hitchhiking around. They were the Dharma bums. And I felt like, well, for me, for my generation, especially the part of Generation X, which is, you know, into the punk rock subculture, that we are the Dharma bums, right? We are the punk. I mean, we are the Dharma punks. We are the, you know, revolutionaries who are committed to a spiritual revolution.
I love it. It's a beautiful evolution, the way you explain it. Can you tell us, yeah, just for people who aren't aware of what it means, what is Dharma?
Dharma, it does have different meanings to different people, right? So you'll get different answers. The Hindus use the term Dharma, and Buddhists use the term Dharma. Hindus use the term Dharma as something that's closer to, like, your fate or your life's path. In Buddhism, the way that the Buddha used the term Dharma was more like the truth with a capital T, that which is absolutely true, not speculative, not philosophy that can be proven wrong, but truth as that you can be verified through your own direct experience. And, you know, so he said there's the Dharma, and the Dharma is going to be what is experienced by anyone who pays really close attention.
Hmm.
So this is different than philosophy or religion that can be more like, you know, you'll never be able to experience this directly for yourself kind of thing.
Yeah, a little more esoteric.
You have to take it on faith. So I think the Dharma goes beyond faith to verify direct experience of what is true about ourselves, about the mind and about, you know, the world. Things like, you know, a core Dharma is impermanence.
Sure, sure.
The truth of constant change is irrefutable. You know, of course, it matches with science. And anybody that pays close attention will see the Dharma of change, will see the truth of impermanence.
So let's talk about Refuge Recovery. This is a wonderful book, by the way, and thank you for writing it. What I noticed in there is just how directly related you bring in Buddhism and Dharma. Could you talk about the concept behind Refuge Recovery? How did, you know, tell us, can you tell us about the four truths of recovery?
Yeah, happy to. So when I decided to take the Buddhist approach to treating addiction, and I know Buddhism very well. I've been studying it for 25 years. There's so many different teachings, different perspectives to come, different Buddhist traditions to pull from. But when I looked at, okay, what's going to be most appropriate and applicable for the addict, what made the most sense was the core and original teachings from the Buddha that are referred to as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is part of the Fourth Noble Truth. Now, this is the Buddha's teaching prescription for humanity, right? He's saying human beings who want to come to enlightenment must follow these four truths, these eight factors, eightfold path. Now, he began that teaching by saying the first thing you have to do in order to end the suffering in our life is acknowledge the suffering in our life. So I adopted this first truth by for the addict of saying, you know, for the addict, in order to get to recovery, first we have to start with an acknowledgement of how much suffering there is in addiction. We have to break denial, minimalization, rationalization, justification, all of the ways that addicts stay stuck, stay sick, because they're not admitting to their innermost self the true nature of how painful it is to be an addict, how much suffering both internally and then the suffering that we cause to others as addicts. So the first truth is acknowledging and accepting the suffering of addiction, and there's a 29-question inventory to be done in order to start that process.
I love the inventory, by the way, and I think it's kind of a wonderful entrance into that. And also there's a lot of parallels between CBT stuff and this as well. And I'm, you know, it might be a little controversial to say that I see a lot of parallels with 12-step work. And it's just a wonderful kind of entrance into that. We're going to talk more about it when we come back after the break. We're talking to Noah Levine, author of Refuge Recovery. You know, this stuff is wonderful stuff for long-term recovery. It's practices that we can all get into. Mm-hmm. I'm a little concerned, Josh, and maybe you can talk about this, about kind of scaring people away from it.
Sure. You know? Yeah, that was my question. You know, how do people, especially people in early recovery, who maybe can grasp that first truth of their acknowledgement of their addiction, of their suffering, but how can they grasp onto something like Refuge Recovery when it might seem a little too lofty or ephemeral or even spiritual to grasp? How can they begin to learn the practicality of these practices?
Right. Well, I think that this is always the question and the dilemma for people when they're facing addiction and how to recover. What we have found we've been doing Refuge Recovery here in Los Angeles for about 6 years, and we found it to be greatly successful. And you know, for all walks of life, for people who, you know, are highly educated and already know about Buddhism and these concepts, and for people who have, you know, no concept of it and want something very simple. Now, talking about it, you know, of course, can get complicated, but the actual experience of starting with mindfulness meditation is that people get a direct experience of how practical it is. And, you know, of course, long inventories are intimidating, but once you start writing and you see the relief that comes from getting it all down on paper, you know, it becomes quite simple. I think that a lot of people, you know, many of us feel like, oh, the 12 steps are so simple. But for a lot of people, when they walk into a 12-step room and they see those 12 things, they're like, wow, this is complicated. This is a lot. So I think in Refuge, we get the same type of feeling from some people who think, oh, this is a little complicated. And, you know, what we ask is, you know, just come hang out. The biggest thing about early recovery, I think, is the community.
Yeah.
And we talk about taking refuge in the community. You don't have to learn all of the foundations, all of the steps, all of the, you know, you just need to get in the room and get the support and, you know, and establish the abstinence. And then you will learn this stuff slowly as you read the book, as you go to the meetings, as you practice the meditation, it will all become clear.
And as you interact with others, the power of the group.
Yeah.
If it's okay, Noah, I'd like to read a little paragraph from your book in the beginning where you talk about, you know, the kind of phenomenon of craving and impermanence. And I'd like you to comment on this. When we spend our lives avoiding unpleasant experiences by taking another drink, devouring another chocolate cake, we are actually causing the unpleasant experiences to last longer than they need to. The unpleasant thoughts, feelings, and sensations are impermanent but also persistent. Trying to push them away is futile and always results in stress, anger, and suffering. It is like we create a dam in the flow of experience. Explain how that kind of lines up with Buddhist thought for us.
Well, I was earlier mentioning the Dharma, the truth of impermanence. So when we're in pain, in discomfort, something difficult, a difficult emotion, some grief, some trauma is arising, it's impermanent. So if we can learn to tend to it and allow it to arise and pass, then there's actually a healthy relationship to it. But when we get in the habitual reaction of every time we're having some discomfort, of replacing it with pleasure, of going back to the drink, to the drugs, to the food, to the sex, then what we're doing is we're suppressing. Like I say in that thing, it's like there's this impermanent phenomena, this stream of sensation or emotion that wants to come through and be acknowledged, but we're creating this dam by avoiding it that then keeps that pain, that trauma, that grief suppressed, where it lives in us and it never gets the attention and healing that it wants to have.
I think you address it so beautifully here, and I want to be able to quote you at our clinic because it's wonderful. It says, when we sober up, the pain is still there waiting to be felt. Some have been successful in suppressing and denying the pain in their lives for long periods of time, but the dam will have always burst eventually, and there is nothing more painful than a lifetime of suppressed pain flooding through all at once. So you bring people to that point. How do they deal, like, you know, give us some real boots on the ground practical practices for dealing with, you know, dealing with the impermanence and contextualizing that?
Well, once we start doing mindfulness meditation practice, the first part of mindfulness is getting people into their bodies, out of the past, out of the future, out of the world that the mind creates, and into the physical reality. And feeling into the breath and the body and the emotions that are here living in the body. And so that is, you know, that's the boots on the ground. That's the work. Come to the present moment and feel what needs to be felt here, however uncomfortable it is, and see for yourself that you actually can tolerate much more than you think. You can sit in much more discomfort than you think. And then by sitting in it, you'll also get the knowledge and the wisdom that the pain is impermanent. If you don't go quickly to avoiding it, you'll see that it passes all by itself.
So
that's something that's so practical and that people really early in recovery can start to learn.
Can you give us, at one of the center in Los Angeles, is there a group of people sitting there? Are they guided meditations? Is there a facilitator? How does it look?
In Refuge Recovery, it's a peer-led recovery movement that includes guided meditations in all of the meetings. So if you come to a Refuge Recovery meeting, there will be a guided meditation that will be led by one of the people in the meeting. So you know, the three of us could have a Refuge Recovery meeting, and I would hand one of you a script of the meditation instructions, and you would lead us in the meditation. So this way you don't have to have a meditation teacher or facilitator. It's peer-led, just like 12 steps, no leader, you know, no hierarchy, no leadership. It's just people getting together and saying, here's the meditation instructions, here's the teachings, let's talk about it and have a meeting and a discussion and a practice period together.
Noah, is this evidence-based treatment? I mean, when you really break it down to the foundation of what it's built upon with meditation and fellowship and learning to, you know, sit through uncomfortable feelings, can you say that it's something that's entirely, you know, useful on a day-to-day basis?
Absolutely. I mean, I can say that 100% from my own direct experience, but it is, of course, anecdotal. I mean, people have been using these practices and teachings for 2,600 years, right? This is an ancient path.
It's a long time.
From the time of the Buddha. Now, when it comes to actual data, scientific data, there's more and more studies being done about mindfulness and about compassion and about kindness and forgiveness, right? Science is starting to catch up and say, let's create evidence base for these kind of spiritual claims.
Sure.
So it's happening. Refuge Recovery itself has not done any kind of clinical studies yet, although I'm totally willing to, and I think that we will do, some clinical studies and both in the peer-led meetings and also in what we're doing in treatment centers. That some of the anecdotal, statistics that I've been given is I was working in a treatment center that's, you know, kind of a 12-step based, you know, psychological-based treatment center. But I was doing two refuge recovery meetings a week, you know, groups where I was facilitating them and teaching them. You know, basically just teaching people Buddhism.
We're gonna take a we're gonna take a short break. When you come back, we're gonna talk to our friend Mike Kelly, who is the co-founder of the Boston chapter of Dharma Punks Recovery Group. Friend Michael Kelly, who's a harm reduction artist and healthcare worker. Michael has worked on the front lines of addiction with prisoners, drug users, and sex workers since 1997. He's been affiliated with the Harm Reduction Coalition and various needle exchange programs. Michael also runs the group Dope Sick San Francisco, or Dope Sick SF, a crew of sober and harm reduction artists. He's also one of the founders. Co-founders of the Boston chapter of Dharma Punks Recovery Group. Michael, welcome back to Right Turn Radio. How
welcome,
you doing,
Michael.
Buddy?
Hey, you guys. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
We can.
Right.
So I understand you're at a little bit of an anniversary today. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're here in Jamaica Plain. I was told not to give the address out because it's at a woman's home.
Okay.
But, you know, we got a bunch of people here that have been affiliated with the Boston Dharma Punks chapter for the last 5 years, just celebrated like a five-year anniversary. And, you know, just it's sort of like a art show, potluck, vegan, you know, Yahoo time, man.
Nice.
Well, yeah. I'm interested in knowing how you came to Dharma Punks, how how Buddhist teachings and all this has affected you in your own recovery, and can you tell us a little bit of your story?
Yeah, I mean, just looking back on it, a lot of people jump into sobriety and then they find some kind of outlet, some kind of spiritual outlet. It was sort of reversed for me. I was sort of tapping into Buddhism due to falling into this this environment in Northern California. It's I forgot the name of the place. It's called San Quentin, and
heard it's lovely there this time of year.
Yeah, the four winds and all that. And I, you know, this is back in my life back then, 20 years ago or so, and what I found in that chaos, you know what I mean, in that that place, man, that place, that dark place where I was in, you know, due to my drugs and alcohol extreme usage, was the connection was sort of right in front of me, and I was able to clearly grasp, for lack of a better term, we're talking about Buddhism, but that addiction and suffering pretty much were going hand in hand, and I just sort of tapped into it there.
Wow, it's like going to that dark, dark place, and maybe you would have never found the light had you not gone there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was Northern California, it's pretty sunny and stuff, but it was an important lesson for me to sort of tap into. It was something that was available to me, something that wasn't rigid and you know, scary.
So how did you come to co-found Dharma Punks here in Boston?
Well, that first of all was like an honor because Noah's book. Noah, are you there? Can you hear me?
I'm here. Hey, Mike.
Hey, brother. Very important book, very important dude right there that you also have on the show. It was something that we needed on the East Coast. It was something that I was able to tap into in California. I was able to, meet Noah and meet some of the people around him and tap into what was available, man. It was a really comfortable setting for like musicians and convicts and weirdos and junkies and to not have to, seek out a monastery or go to Thailand or drop like $1,000 for a weekend retreat somewhere. It was really accessible. It was really cool. Bunch of people that were just getting together and meditating, and that was really helpful, especially in my early recovery. Long answer, but you know, sort of what it was.
Yeah,
No, that's great. Noah, hearing this, was your intention when you started Dharma, you know, when you wrote Dharma Punks, for this kind of thing to happen, or was it a surprise to you?
It wasn't really my intention behind writing the book. I was really just writing the book because I thought it would, you know, help introduce people to Buddhism and take some of the stigma away from it and say this is a really practical tool for living and, of course, for recovery. You know, in a lot of ways, Dharma Punks is a recovery memoir of my addiction that brought me to Buddhism and recovery. So I was just thinking, oh, this will help spread the message. But then as the message got spread, so many people came to me and said, okay, you got us interested, but where do we practice it?
Sure.
Right? And so, and kind of like what Mike is saying, like, okay, you got us interested, and you're cool, and your people are cool, but we go to these Buddhist centers, and they're not that cool, you know? They're not, like, that accepting, you know? The old ladies are, like, holding their pocketbooks when these tattooed thugs come in to go meditate. So, you know, what are we going to do? So I just started telling people, like Mike and lots of people, like, start your own group. You know, you don't need a teacher. You just need each other. Like, get together and meditate and you know, maybe do some book studies and just support each other in this path. And I think a lot of that came from my own recovery and the 12-step, you know, sort of peer-led, non-hierarchical. You know, I'm a punk rocker. I believe in DIY, you know, do it yourself. You don't have to wait for somebody's permission.
That's right.
Just, like, start a group and support each other and meditate together.
No, I'm thinking of somebody who's, like, in really early treatment, like somebody who went to detox for alcohol or drugs. How are they going to find out about Dharma Punks, about these communities that are out there, compared to, you know, what is usually pushed, which is very traditional approaches to recovery from substance abuse?
Hey, can I tap into that?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, check this out, because I actually work in a detox setting. I work in a dual diagnosis unit. And it's like, it's really about the people that are working in these places. I mean, that's us. You know what I mean? It's people like that like John and Woody that have Right Charm. Right Charm were actually the facility that hosted this group when we first started out. We used to meet on Sunday afternoons when there were no meetings going on there. A DIY approach, you know what I mean? And the whole thing is like where I work, I have a video of Noah's. It's a great clip, Meditate and Destroy. We actually use it for a group. We play it to expose people to alternative Buddhism.
Alternative approaches, yeah.
And it's a huge piece of harm reduction.
So the people on the front lines can sort of be the ambassadors to this idea and this movement.
Word.
Of course, and I also feel like, you know, with the internet now, people do a web search, they find it, you know? They find what they're looking for. And it's a big part of the motivation behind, you know, putting Refuge Recovery out there. And, you know, unlike Dharma Punks, where it wasn't my intention to form groups, with Refuge Recovery, it's totally my intention for people to start meeting, you know, and to start refuge groups so that in the coming years it will be a more and more common thing for someone to get out of treatment and be able to find a Buddhist recovery group to go to.
I'm interested to know, because we've talked a lot about it, how do you respond to people who feel conflicted or they find conflict between the refuge recovery approach and, like, traditional 12-step recovery? Is there a conflict?
It depends on the individual. For some people, there will be conflict. On the biggest level, I feel like, you know, Buddhism is really beautiful because it's non-theistic, right? There's no God involved in Buddhism. It's really just practical, applicable, you know, spiritual psychology. So if you believe in God, if you believe in a higher power, if that's part of your thing from the 12 steps, Buddhism isn't telling you to not believe in that. It's just not addressing that part. So, you know, theists, people who believe in God, are totally welcome in Buddhism. But what Buddhism has that, you know, some of the perspectives don't have, which is that if you don't believe in God, if you are an agnostic or if you are an atheist and that Judeo-Christian philosophy doesn't resonate with you, Buddhism is a really great fit for people like that So I really feel like, you know, Refuge fits for people who believe in God, for people who don't believe in God, and for people who are still trying to figure out what they believe. And I think that this is a bit different than the 12 steps that have some level of you have to believe, you know. And, you know, they're very open-minded, and they say, you know, you can find your own concept and whatever you understand it to be, but you have to come to believe. And Buddhism is saying you don't have to believe anything. You just got to do the work, and then you will know for yourself what is and isn't true in your own direct experience.
So like the experience of practice versus the experience of faith is what I'm hearing.
Much more a verified path.
I like it. It sounds like they can happily coexist. Like I mentioned before, I see, and Michael alluded to it, you know, a lot of these tools that you are giving us in refuge recovery can be adapted to a clinical setting and certainly make a lot of sense, you know, for people in early and mid and long-term recovery. I think, Josh, this is one of those things that you and I can adapt.
Sure.
in at Right Turn, where we work. Michael, what do you want people to know about this? What do you want other recovering people to know about Dharma Punks and this type of recovery?
That's a good question, man. I guess right off the bat that it's a comfortable spot, man. I was thinking about the last question you guys asked Noah about the old traditional AA folk and all that, and it's like this is an outlet for people that might be wrestling with that higher power concept or might not get some of the terminology down that sort of scares them. I mean, I'm in AA, you know what I mean? And it's another thing that helped shape me and save my life, but it's like, dude, you've seen some of my artwork. I do like all this intense collage stuff and found art stuff. So it's like, I'll grab what's healthy over here, grab what's healthy over there, and then create who I am. You know what I mean? Because for me and a lot of the people and a lot of the junkies that I know, the ones that are recovering, the ones that are trying to get there, man, it's we're not down for the whole uniform, the whole kind of rigid type of approach to it. And like I said, don't get me wrong, I'm in AA, man, but it's like you got to grab what you can from the healthy areas. And this has always been a healthy thing, man. And it's like when I was wandering around in San Francisco trying to get sober, I remember finding the Urban Dharma group out there, the back of the bus group, which is one of the oldest Dharma Punks groups. Noah can give you the history on it better than I could, but I remember like I was in this building trying to find it, and I saw this huge pile of like Doc Martens and Chuck Taylors because you had to take your shoes off before you went in, and I was like, that's it, I'm home, man. It just took a bunch of, you know, smelly shoes to show me where I was.
That's great.
You know what I mean? That's all it took was a bunch of like, you know, a bunch of shoes.
You knew you had found your tribe.
You know what? These are my people.
That's right. Mike, with that in mind, this question sort of relates to that. So who's the demographic these days? What does the typical demographic look like? And is it still something that's like very greatly attached to punk rock? Or do you see some of these little old ladies who might be clutching their purses becoming attracted to this?
Well, any old ladies and purses are welcome, okay? But what I can...
And I'd love Noah to talk about this too.
All right, yeah, I'll give you a quick answer and let him take it, man. But I can tell you right now, the event we're at this house in Jamaica Plain, if you scan the room, the meditation and the discussion today, I mean, you know, there's like the core of us, you know, tattooed dudes, gold teeth, wicked cool hair, that kind of stuff, beautiful girls, and there's other people here. We have people here from all walks of life. We have people up here from New York. We have people that are actually working. They work in the business sector. We have a wonderful woman who's hosting this event is a doctor. You know what I mean? I would love to have a doctor that was tapping into this stuff, because that's a whole nother, you know, discussion we can have on your radio, you know what I mean, about the medical treatment that's going on and all that. But
And Noah, what are you seeing? Are you seeing, is this like more appealing to a younger crowd?
Well, it's very mixed, you know. I would say like about 30% of the room are like Generation X, you know, punk rock, you know, subculture alternative people. And then, you know, there's like 20% of the room that are, you know, like even younger, like 20-somethings, you know, the next generation young people. And then half of the room are like civilians, you know, what I would call civilians.
Yeah.
You know, working class, you know, urban professionals, lots of psychologists, lots of doctors, lots of therapists, you know, lots of people that are just looking for, you know, mindfulness and Buddhism have become so popular. And we're one of the, you know, very few recovery-friendly, you know, groups that is really serious about meditation. So it's very mixed. Everyone's welcome. You know, once in a while I'll hear people say, oh, you know, I feel uncomfortable because I don't have tattoos, you know, because I'm covered in tattoos. A lot of people in our community are. But if you really take a time to look around the room, it's probably only 30% of the room that actually has tattoos.
Sure.
You know, the majority of the people in the room are not, you know, so radical, you know, that they're really, you know, from all walks of life.
Well, and the important thing is they're finding recovery as a group. They found their tribe, like Mike said. How do people access this information? Where can people go to get information about Refuge Recovery?
People can go to refugerecovery.org. That's one of the websites. And, you know, really what I encourage is if you're hearing this and you're interested, pick up the book. You know, you can pick up the book anywhere at the, you know, local bookstore. You can order it online. You can order it from us on the website. Give it a read and then, you know, see, do you resonate with it? Does it make sense to you? And then find a refuge meeting. If a refuge meeting doesn't exist in your neighborhood, start one. You know, consider starting one. We'll post it on our website. You know, and that's how this thing is going to grow organically, just the way the 12 steps grow organically.
Very cool.
The refuge book came out coincidentally on June 10th, which was the 79th anniversary of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what those guys did. They got together, they wrote the book, and they said, let's see if this thing is going to grow.
The grassroots movement.
To the point where there's millions of meetings.
I love it. I want to thank you, Noah Levine, founder of Refuge Recovery and the author of the new book. And thanks for being on Right Turn Radio. And Michael Kelly, thanks so much for being here again. We'd love to have you guys both back on. We love what you're doing. I'm going to get some more information for the work I do because I think it's really good stuff. Thanks again, gentlemen, for being on Right Turn Radio.
Thank you, guys.
Good night.
So Josh, I love this, man.
I gotta say, it's such a well-written book. It's an easy read. Anybody can pick it up and really grasp the concepts that are being discussed, which is helpful, I think.
And it's a different, you know, Mike was talking about, he's a member of a 12-step fellowship, but it's one from column A, one from column B, whatever works. We're always saying that. Doesn't matter. You don't have to go the well-worn path. You can find your own recovery, just find it with other people.
Sure, we were extremists in addiction. We don't have to be extremists in recovery.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.